Hi, this is Paul Dillon and welcome to The Office Block. This is our first podcast and you're very welcome. We're a space for people who work in finance. We aim to bring you the best in finance news, views and opinion. But it's your voice that matters, so tweet us at the OB Tweets or find us on Facebook and Instagram at The Office Block. We have a great show lined up for episode one. Have a panel discussion later on with journalists Jack Horgan-Jones and Emma Kennedy and solicitor Richard Grogan. But before that, I'm going to bring you an interview with Deirdre Curran from NUIG. Okay, great. Deirdre, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Deirdre, we want to talk to you today about the topic of stress in the workplace and its causes and its effect on people. Can you tell us what you think in terms of the extent to which stress is an issue in today's workplace?
Okay, so it might be useful if I start off just saying a little bit about myself so that you can understand the context that I'm coming from. So I'm an academic working in NUI Galway. I've been working here for 20 years. And my academic background myself is in psychology. And then I went round the houses and I ended up working in the business school here at NUI Galway. So I often say to my students that I consider myself a subversive in the business school because I'm more anti-business than pro-business. And the reason I say that is that my concern is to look at the impact, usually negative impact, that business has on human beings. And so in work, my day job, a lot of my day-to-day teaching is around the area of employment relations and the relationship between workers and employers and how that relationship can go wrong. And so I often premise my courses by saying to the students, you know, that an underlying theme of my teaching is that bad things happen to people at work. And I say to them, you know, that may sound very negative, but from my experience, it's, you know, there's a lot of fact basis to that, and that what I want them to be at the age of 18 and 19 is aware that bad things can happen, but also be aware that they are not powerless, that there are things that they can do if bad things happen to them at work. And so so most of my teaching is around the employment relationship and employment law and workplace conflict, and then my research is around mediation as a means for resolving workplace conflict. So that's the kind of background that I'm coming from. And, you know, when you say to what extent do you think stress is an issue in the workplace, as an academic, if I read the usual sources, there's not so much talk about stress now. And that's not to suggest that stress has gone away. If anything, in my view, stress is more of an issue today than it ever was. But the emphasis has changed. And so what they talk about in the academic literature is mental ill health and employee well-being. They're kind of two sides of the one coin. But if you read about mental ill health in the workplace or employee well-being in the workplace, and there's lots of stuff coming out around those two headings, it's stress. It's the same thing again. You know, so it's back to the old literature on stress. You know, the same things that cause stress in the workplace are causing mental ill health. Avoiding them will promote employee well-being. The consequences of, you know, of lack of employee well-being is the same as the consequences that they wrote about in relation to stress 20 or 30 years ago. And the mechanisms for avoiding mental ill health and promoting employee well-being are the same as the mechanisms they talked about for reducing stress in the workplace years ago. So the term stress isn't as commonly used, but the fact of stress, because if you look at how the literature defines stress, it talks about excessive pressures on individuals. That, if anything, is worse than it ever was.
Can I come in there at that? And I think you've hit on a really important point that we would see, we say, in the legal field.
Yeah.
That people come in and now we've got these nice sanitized titles about everything. And I think it goes back to the time that I think when I was in school and I saw an ad for a fuel injection engineer, which actually was a petrol pump attendant. So what we've done here now is we've talked about employee well-being.
Yeah.
And really, the issue of stress, there are good stresses. And I think everybody would accept there are good stress. I would work and I have what I call good stress. In other words, it's a case that's running or I'm doing work for somebody and you expect good stress. But there is a line, and effectively what we would see is that a lot of employers really are not prepared to deal with it. and it's more an issue for the managers rather than the people higher up. Then, in other words, the managers haven't been
Absolutely.
Trained to recognise. And that's where the problem is coming in from, not from the managers and the HR department who have great policies, but actually it's the manager who is putting people under unrealistic targets because of targets they're being put under, and that this is a growing problem because we certainly see it coming into our office. Difficulty is that the recent Roughly case has now put the test of proving stress so high that it's nearly impossible to get the claim through the courts unless you've got a serious, you know, mental illness or physical illness because of it.
Well, there are three things that come to mind there as you're talking. One is that if you read the academic literature on stress, the old literature, they describe stress as an inverted curve. As the curve is going up, that's referred to as eustress, which is stress that actually positively impacts your performance. And when the curve is going down again, you're into distress, which is where stress is negatively affecting performance. And where the curve turns, you've got the optimum. And so in terms of maximizing individual, you know, or organization performance, you have to make sure that people have enough eustress to feel challenged and motivated, but not to tip over the edge of that curve. The other thing that comes to mind is, I know what you mean about the terms. You know, as an academic, there are terms in the literature that make my skin crawl. And I mean, I would rather talk about stress than employee well-being. It's almost a positive spin to make it look like it's not such a bad thing. And then there are other terms like talent management and various terms that employee engagement, you know, these kind of terms are all kind of fashionable HR terms that appear for a while and then disappear again. And the third thing that you said there that triggered something for me is, you know, if it comes to a legal case, absolutely the role of line managers is critical. And, you know, I had hoped that would come up at some stage. Absolutely critical is the role of the line manager. But they're often under huge stress themselves, and they're often not trained properly, and they're not supported properly, and therefore it becomes a vicious cycle. And then the last point from what you were saying is, for me, if it gets to a legal case, it's almost too late. What we need is interventions that will either prevent stress from happening in the first place or deal with it in a way that is as close as possible to source as quickly as possible with the minimum impact on people's lives and health.
Well, I would have to agree with you on that. I mean, solicitors' offices make their money out of these cases, but I mean, our approach would always be, and I think most solicitors who do employment work, is that we don't want to see these cases coming in, because that means that management has fallen down, and nobody in my profession goes around and wants somebody to be injured. And stress is a form of injury that often can have far greater effect on people than a broken arm or a broken leg in a car accident case. This can be a lifelong issue for them.
Deirdre, just coming back to some of the issues around language, to what extent do you see stress as a health and safety issue in work? Because I'm guessing that a lot of employers don't want to see it as part of a health and safety issue.
Right. Well, it absolutely is a health and safety issue. But I would be concerned about it being restricted to that kind of pigeonhole. But it absolutely is a health and safety issue, because one of the consequences of stressed individuals is they're more likely to have accidents and incidents in the workplace. And the second point about health and safety is your employer has a duty of care to you. And so, you know, under the health and safety legislation, they're obliged to provide, you know, a safe workplace. And that's not just safe physically, it's safe mentally as well. So it absolutely is a health and safety issue. And I mean, if you read some of the stuff that's been written around mental ill health, which concerns me greatly in the modern workplace, and it's very related to stress. You know, some of the statistics or the figures that come out are pretty stark. So I've a couple of them just jotted down here beside me. So
go ahead.
Last year in the UK, over 480,000 people reported that work-related stress was making them ill. You know, and I get very animated about this in class, because I say to the students, no employer has the right to make you ill. And yet workers are becoming ill in the workplace because of stress. There was another statistic that one in four of us will experience mental ill health at some point in our lives. It's going to happen to one in four of us at some point. you know, and that might either be caused by work or be caused by circumstances outside of work. And so mental ill health is a huge issue in the modern workplace. And years ago, stress used to be, you know, there was a real stigma around talking about stress. I think that's improved a lot. Now the stigma has shifted to mental ill health. People don't want to talk about it. And yet it is a very, very significant issue. There was another, Bupa did a survey and they found that 40% of workers had experienced depression as a result of being stressed. 21% of their respondents had experienced prolonged stress for over a year and 12% were close to breaking point. You know, so it's pretty shocking. You know, we all know that stress is an issue. All of us experience stress.
Can I say to you, I think you've raised a very important point. And one of the things I think that the statistics don't show is that it's people who are stressed above individuals who actually cause stress to other people. So that this is a kind of a vicious circle that unfortunately, if employers look at it the right way, if you eradicate stress, you increase productivity and therefore you actually increase the bottom line. So that so dealing with stress shouldn't be regarded as a negative. In fact, actually, it's a positive, because if you have a sick workforce, they're not going to be as productive as a healthy workforce. And if you've got a healthy workforce, they make you more money. So it's actually good business to have a very positive attitude, and to have a positive attitude of reporting problems early, because when they're reported early and the HR department is properly trained, then it can help resolve the issues by getting proper treatment.
Jack, just go to you there. Yeah,
yeah, Deirdre, I have a question. So we hear a lot about how employment in general is becoming more tenuous,
yeah,
right? You know, people on short-term contracts or people working in the gig economy and so on and so forth. Do you think that of necessity increases workplace stress as well? And if so, is that one of a number of factors that are making the workplace a more stressful area for people at the moment? I note that in your intro you said, you know, it's only getting worse.
I absolutely do. So, I mean, if you were to ask me, you know, what do I think are the biggest issues impacting human beings in the workplace, in my top five would be precarious work. Would be one of them. Work intensification would be another. And a lack of worker voice and representation would probably be a third. So so how I met Paul originally, from the FSU there, is that there was an event in Galway, a One Galway event, where all the unions in Galway got together over a single issue, and that single issue was precarious work. Now, when you think of precarious work, you think of, you know, the guys who drive around on mopeds delivering food. But what that event signified and highlighted was the fact that precarious work is everywhere. It's in the third level sector. It's in the health sector. It's in childcare. It's in hospitality. And what precarious work is, what it represents for me, is a tipping of the balance of power back towards the employer in a way that is negative for workers. So
I'd say non-compete contracts would be another example of that, would they?
Yeah. And so the power is all in the hands of the employers, and they are determining when people work and how long people work for. And when people are on precarious contracts and they have no control over their working life, then that is extremely stressful and can have consequences for mental health, and makes people insecure in terms of their job and insecure in terms of their finances and their ability to live.
So I like the phrase that you're using, work intensification. I mean, I think really we need to stop putting some of these titles on it. This is what I call 24/7, 365 working that has been brought in. And rather than saying, putting that kind of a title, which does to a certain extent sanitize it, what we're talking about is people working very long hours, seven days a week, and that it's the problem on it is, and I don't criticize academics, we all like to put a nice title on everything, and titles
criticize
sound very
academics
good.
Academics all you like.
I do most of
so
the
do
time,
I.
So don't worry about it. Yeah, but I read a lot of the stuff that they put out. So, but what I would say to you is, I don't like that phraseology. I actually like the that we use what I call yellow jam, not marmalade, and it's called working too many hours. And working too many days and not getting enough
and
holidays.
Working too hard.
That this is, Well, there's nothing wrong with working hard.
But there's something wrong with working too hard. So you can be working too many hours and not working hard enough.
Sorry, I mean, look, can I say this to you? I take a view that somebody comes in and they have a 9-to-5 job. They have their breaks, but other than that, they're down there to work. However, it's the 24/7 approach that is wrong. And what I call it now is, what I call it is the US system. In other words, you have huge presenteeism in the workplace, spending a lot of time having meetings about nothing, and sometimes meeting about agendas, rather than actually getting down and doing the work. And that if the work is concertinaed in, people get their breaks and their rest periods, but it's this fact of being in and available at 6:30 on the email and still doing at 11 o'clock at night, that's the problem. And whether they're even being productive is another
issue. Electronic communication has a big responsibility there. And I mean, there are companies in some countries of the world where there's a ban on contacting people through electronic means after working hours. But we don't have that here. And so you're online, you know, even if you're not in the office, you're online for a lot of your time. And one of the reasons that people go to work is for social interaction. And I mean, I work as an academic and, you know, I know people would have perceptions about what it's like to work in academia, but I can tell you that I would hardly ever sit down and have a cup of coffee with my colleagues, and I would hardly ever have lunch with them. I'd more likely go downstairs, get the coffee, bring it back up and continue as I am.
Deirdre, can I just come in at two things that struck me about what you said? You mentioned the term voice at work. And I'm just curious, what does that mean exactly? Do you mean people getting together, having a sense of collectivity, bringing issues forward to the employer? Because it strikes me that, as you say, that sort of individualization can cause a lot of stress and difficulty.
Yeah, so I mean, when I was thinking about going to be talking to you today, I was thinking about what are the things that workers can do themselves in order to make things better? And one of the things they can do is speak up and speak out. But that's not always that easy, because you have to work in a trusting environment where it's okay for you to criticize the workplace, constructively criticize the workplace. And in a lot of workplaces, that's not actually the case. And so a new phenomenon in the academic literature talks about employee silence, that workers are staying silent. Even if they know something is wrong and they know that it could be better, they are staying silent because that environment of trust isn't there that encourages them to use their voice and speak up and speak out with a view to making things better. And if you're in a workplace where you don't feel comfortable speaking out, then my advice would be find someone who will speak out on your behalf. And that's where unions come in, because, you know, as an individual, if I speak out here, which I am wont to do, I could actually be victimized depending on, you know, on whether they want to hear what I have to say or not. But if you go through a trade union, because they're an independent and indirect mechanism for employee voice, then it's much safer and potentially much stronger. And so that's why I think, you know, initiatives like this that you're undertaking, Paul, are so good, because you're bringing the union to the attention of people who need to know that it's there and that it will protect them and that it will speak up for them if they feel they can't speak up for themselves.
And one thing I think that maybe is important as well, and I think it's lost a lot of the time, and that's the role of the press in this, because the press have a huge role in play in actually bringing issues to the fore, reporting on cases, and actually going out and doing the investigative journalism that highlights the issues, that enables people to say, yeah, actually, that affects me, and I actually now think I can go and say something about it. So I think that unions are fantastic, and I have great respect for unions, but I actually think sometimes the unsung heroes on this is actually the press.
We're also a great example of a kind of low stress environment that never intrudes into the family or home life.
What about yourself, Jack? Do you see stress at work as a big issue in journalism and the media sector? Because obviously, in terms of finance and banking, these issues are really, really coming up all the time. And that's the reason we're having Deirdre on to discuss it. Mm. Stress is a really, really big workplace issue. Do you find the same?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, so part of me is like kind of, you sign up to be a journalist and stress, and I think actually we need to delineate between stress and pressure, right? I think pressure is fine. Pressure is, you know, your boss asking you to do something that tests your ability to do your job and you find out whether you're able to do it or not. And that's workplace pressure, and I don't really have a problem with that. Stress is something that you can't really do anything about. You know, stress is kind of this omnipresent, all-enveloping thing that you carry around with you. You take it home after work, it's there with you in work, and it can be quite damaging, you know. And I think that pressure is part of journalism, whether it's deadline pressure, whether it's performance pressure, you know. So I kind of think you sign up for that. But then again, a lot of the things that we've been talking about here, like the advent of the smartphone, you know, like there's not a day, like a single day I can recall, including Sundays and holidays recently, that I haven't had to at least fire off a few texts or a few emails. And then there's other things that are specific maybe to the media, like the business model underpinning certainly newspaper journalism is misfiring, to say the very least. So there's fewer people working, you know, but there's still the same amount of pages to fill. In fact, the advertising is giving out as well, so there's probably more space in those pages to fill, yet there's fewer people to do it. So that's another interesting kind of threshold issue. What happens when an industry starts to misfire a little bit, and what kind of impact does that have on the people that are in there? And that can be the case in industries as well that aren't actually underperforming. You know, something like automation can bring that to play as well. Like, you can never say financial services is necessarily underperforming on a kind of profit or loss basis, but certainly more and more tasks are being automated, and that changes the role for people who are there, left there in the branches.
Deirdre, it's been really great, and I have to say most interesting to have you on the show. I really felt that you brought a lot forward there in terms of some of the issues, but just want to leave you on one final thought, which is technology and work and stress. Because obviously there is a huge amount of issues that have been mentioned there by yourself and Jack and Richard in terms of after hours work and so on and so forth. Do you have any advice? You've given good advice in terms of advice at work, but any advice on how to deal with that sense of stress and technology at work?
Well, I think what I was referring to earlier there about, you know, about the organisation putting restrictions on what's acceptable behaviour in relation to the use of technology, you know, and restrictions on when people can be contacted would be a start. But, you know, just to widen it out a bit, and just in case I don't get the opportunity to mention this, when I was doing a bit of preparation for this conversation, I came across research that has been done in the banking sector about mental ill health in the banking sector in the UK. And what they did was, because of the increased prevalence of mental ill health within the financial services in the UK, they embarked on a training program for line managers, which brings us back to what we were saying at the beginning about line managers being critical. And so they identified the banking sector as being specifically prone to mental ill health, and line managers as being particularly critical. And therefore, they devised this training program. And it's been piloted in four banks, I think, in the UK. And then it was evaluated by the CIPD, the Chartered Institute for Personnel Development. So that would be an interesting kind of resource for people like yourself, Paul, who are looking at this issue, or for anybody within the bank, to see what is the makeup of that training and whether we need something more specific, you know, to be introduced into the Irish banking sector to help people deal with or line managers deal with the increased rate of stress and ill health, mental ill health within their employees.
Deirdre, it's been great to have you on the show.
Great to talk to all of you.
We'll have you on again, and thanks very much for joining us on the Office Block.
Okay, thanks a lot.
So that was Deirdre Curran from NUIG. I said at the top of the show that we want to hear from you about what's on your agenda so that we can cover it on the show. Check out our site, theofficeblock.org, for more content, more issues that we feel will be of interest, and get involved in the conversation. Now to our panel. I'm joined on the phone from Paris by journalist Emma Kennedy. You're welcome, Emma.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
And we have Jack Horgan-Jones of the Sunday Business Post.
Hey, Paul.
And we have Richard Grogan.
Hello.
So we've had a pretty interesting interaction there with Deirdre, but I want to talk about a few issues that are on the news agenda at the present time. Data is dominating almost everything at the moment. We've had the big Facebook story in Cambridge Analytics, and now we have the INM, Dennis O'Brien story. And there's a whole set of issues around data, but I just want to give you this quote from Garrett Murphy of the Financial Services Union, where he wrote an article about data and employers. He said, employers are increasingly watching, monitoring, recording, analysing and controlling every second of every day of their workplace in order to drive efficiencies in labour processes and get every last effort out of their workers. We'll return to that in a moment, but I want to come to you first, Jack. It's been wall-to-wall data news. Facebook, Cambridge Analytics and INM. What are the big takeaways for you?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's that kind of nauseating truism that gets trotted out from time to time, which is that data is the new oil, right? And I think that there was some research done recently by one of the investment banks, which actually said, no, it's not just the kind of empty cliche anymore. Data actually is more valuable than oil. I mean, if you look at the publicly quoted companies, the most valuable ones in aggregate now have data as their main business as opposed to oil, which is traditionally the most valuable asset to control. So I think that's kind of the cornerstone of you know, a lot of these stories that we're talking about at the moment, whether it's Facebook, whether it's INM, and, you know, whether it's any story that hits the headlines has an element of data in at the moment. Where it's interesting for you guys and for unions in general is how it applies to employment relationships, how it applies to the worker themselves, and the degree to which you own your data. And there's just a little interesting little vignette that I came across recently, which is professional footballers, certainly not someone who you think would need the aid of an agency or of a union anytime soon, but there is a big discussion over whether a professional footballer or a professional athlete actually owns their injury data. So because it's data, you know, that pertains to my broken leg or my broken arm, you would think automatically, you know, this is my data. It's about my physical body. But of course, if you are looking to buy that player, or, you know, if you're looking to whether or not to give that player a new contract, it's going to be very interesting to you the strength of how that fibula has healed, or whether that skull fracture is going to reoccur, you know. So you can see how there is this crossover dynamic between that which arises in the physical, you know, or in the employment, and whose right it is to control it, and how it affects your employment rights going forward, and indeed your earning power going forward.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and in terms of the big issues that we've had in the media in the last number of weeks, Jack, we've had wall to wall data. What do you think? Is there any lessons that we can draw from that in terms of?
Don't trust Facebook.
And what about trusting your employer?
Because
INM is an employer as well as a media outlet.
I think. The one of the real object lessons that's going to emerge from this, right, is the idea that you have to be extremely careful with your data. Because I think there was this lazy assumption amongst people that you could trust the people who you were providing your data with to behave in a responsible way. And I think that the Facebook scandal has really undermined that idea. And Facebook in the public mind has gone from, you know, this platform that was all about connecting people and all these kind of fuzzy, you know, feel good ideas to being seen, I think, more accurately as a bad actor and someone who has not lived up to the duty of care they have over your data, and in fact is more interested in your data than your well-being, and is more interested in exploiting that for its own profit than you know, connecting people or anything like that. Do you know what I mean? So I think that's the main object lesson to emerge from that. And then you have the INM stuff coming on alongside that, and you realise that your employer is in an extremely effective place to gather data on you. And a lot of this stuff goes back years as well. This like some of the emails that are being talked about in relation to INM go back to 1999, when, you know, data was certainly a lot less omnipresent, and the capacity to gather it and so on and so forth was a lot less omnipresent. And you realize that you've left this kind of data signature over years or decades, and, you know, your employer is one of the is uniquely placed, I would argue, to pick that up and, you know, potentially use it against you, you know.
Richard, just bring you in there about the rights of employers vis-a-vis workers' data and their staff data.
All right. Well, I mean, I think Jack actually raised a great point, and that's the professional footballer, and maybe that's a very good example as to say how it applies. Under GDPR, which comes in on the 25th of May, an employer is entitled to maintain and keep what is legitimate information. So therefore, if you're playing for a football club and you've had an injury, that's legitimate to them. However, if you're playing for Manchester United and you've broken your fibula and they're thinking of selling you to West Ham, cheap, they can't turn around and say, well, here's his medical report, because that's personal to you. And I think the issue on it is an employer can take anything that is legitimate. So if you're in a dealing room, of course they're going to want to record the deals that you're doing, because that's a very important issue, because they need to know what's been done and what's been said and has anything funny been done financially. But they're only entitled to maintain that for as long as it is necessary. And therefore, they can't say, well, we need to keep this until the year 3000. So, I mean, it's how long is it necessary. And after that, it needs to be got rid of and destroyed. I think the issue of trust is a huge issue. And I think a lot of people got it wrong with Facebook. And I would suppose, as an employment lawyer, whether we're acting for employers or employees, the first thing we're going to is actually Facebook. What has Jack Horgan-Jones put on his Facebook? So there's a lot of injury cases that go through or employment cases that go through. And you have somebody who says, oh, I wasn't able to work. And then you have a picture of them on a banana boat out in Spain. And
it's not working, apparently.
Yes, and you're going, yeah, well, if your back was that bad mm-hmm. that you couldn't work and you couldn't seek work, how were you on a banana boat? So I think one of the things that people have is the issue of trust is now, with come the 25th of May, you're going to be entitled to say to your employer, what information do you have on me? I want a copy of it. And it's not going to cost me anything. It's 6:35. It is the moment. Now it's going to cost nothing.
And would you encourage people to do that, Richard?
I think I would. And I tell you, the reason for it is the employer has 30 days to give it to you. Or if there's a lot of it, they can say, look, we've got so much, it's going to take us a bit longer. Mm. But it does mean then that if they've been recording, if they've been videoing you, all of that has to be given to you. And you're entitled to go back and say, hold on, this is a video of me walking into the dealing room in 2013. What relevance has that got? Well, I want that deleted. So a lot of companies now are deleting an awful lot of information that is unnecessary. And so what's going to be there is necessary information. And that's, of course, going to be things like your name and your address. And if you've had an accident at work, you know, your contact details to who you go, who they phone. But not, you know, a disciplinary that you had in the year 2000 when you were a junior office worker in the place and now you're a senior person. That should be off your personnel file. So I think I would be saying to employees to go to the HR department and say, I want to know what information you have on me. I want to make sure that it's up to date, and I want anything that is out of date filled out of the file, destroyed and got rid of. But I think a lot of employees, they should trust their employer, but I suppose I was trained when I was a trainee solicitor many, many years ago, and the man who was training me said that you must always trust your bookkeeper. And I said, but they're dealing with cash. And he said, yes. Well, he said, I trust them automatically. But he said, then, of course, he said, I do a trial balance once a week. So I suppose there is a bit of you must trust your employer. But then it's a question of checking. And it is a question of checking what's on your file. And I would say to any employee, come the 26th of May, write to your employer and say, what information have I got? Now, you might even be better off now saying, I'm going to write to you on the 26th of May when it's going to cost me diddly squat to get this information, and you're only going to have 30 days. So now you better go and find out what you have and fill up out anything that's irrelevant for me, because come the 26th, I'm going to be asking for a copy of it. So, I mean, I would say to employers, now you've got to do this. Mm. And it's a huge issue, and it's going to be a huge cost for business.
Emma, to what extent has this become a global issue in terms of how companies are dealing with data? I mean, are you finding that as something that's arising as you, because you cover issues right across the world in terms of finance and banking and so on?
Yeah, I suppose my main focus would tend to be things like personal finance, social finance, so I suppose the punter side of finance, for want of a better word. And and I think there's a lot of concern among people. Say, for example, everything from your interactions with financial services companies, for example, things like mortgages, insurance, people give a lot of data, and they are very concerned about the security of that data and also the transparency of it. And one thing that I think might become more of an issue in the future, Richard mentioned there how the employer deals with data.
And I suppose if we look at labour markets where we have tightness, I wonder in the future, could this become an issue? So if companies have data breaches and are seen to not treat their employees' data with sufficient care, or seem to hold stuff that they don't need to, or record things that employees feel uncomfortable with, will that then become something that nearly becomes a labour market issue in time? That people choose employers based on, in the same way they now look at things like what's the pension plan like, or what kind of salaries, or what's the culture in that company? Does data become part of company culture and their approach to data become part of employment, people's approach to hiring?
Well, they're going to be, come the 25th of May, employers are going to be liable to be prosecuted if there's a breach of their staff data. So, you know, it's going to become a major issue because it's going to be the one of trust. Either they're trusted to keep the data correctly and to make sure that only proper data is maintained, or they're going to get a very bad name if they end up being fined, because the employee now can sue them for both not getting the information, or if they have released their information. So, you know, this is a major area of litigation that's going to come down the road. So it's just good business to make sure you keep it safe. But I agree with you fully, Emma.
And they're quite chunky fines as well under GDPR. And I know I've only heard this discussed in the context of what Facebook could be hit with. And ultimately, it doesn't really matter what Facebook could be hit with because they've got so many billions offshore. But I think the figures are like 4% of global turnover in the worst case scenario.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about millions.
Yeah.
This is not something that is, you know, down to the district court slap on the wrist. This is major money that can be hit. So that this is a major issue of trust. And I think financial organisations will be very careful to make sure that they attract the best people by being the best data per firms.
Challenging as well presumably for employers, right? Because there's going to be a cost of compliance to all this too.
Well, we've had a couple of years, but like anything else in Ireland, we rarely get round to it until after the legislation has come in.
Let's look at another issue that's, you know, been in the news a lot recently, which is Brexit. I'm interested, Emma, in talking to you about this because we've had a huge debate in the papers and there's been yards of print, acres of print about Brexit and what it means and so on. But I'm interested in bringing you in because we want to have a conversation about what the financial services sector in Ireland looks at post-Brexit. And you've written a lot about the social finance and what that might mean. What role could social finance play in the finance sector in Ireland post-Brexit?
Well, I suppose maybe just to park the Brexit question for a second and look at social finance more broadly. I suppose within social finance, it's a very broad church. It encompasses lots of different things. And I think people's understanding of it might vary from one person to the next, but it's everything from lending to social enterprises, lending to charities, impact investing. So that's like bonds that are a pay-for-success bond. Some people would include philanthropy under that section. I suppose the general tone of it is actually putting your money where your mouth is. So be it investors investing in things that deliver both a financial return and a social one, or be it banks and financial services companies looking at things through that lens. But I suppose it seems to be a market across the world, both in Irish context, UK and beyond, that is getting a lot more traction. And there's a sort of talk. I interviewed someone before Christmas on this, and he likened it to that impact and sustainability is effectively the Silicon Valley of finance. It's the bit where financial services companies are interested. It's where the innovation is. Obviously, there's other areas that are innovative, but I think if you look at it in that lens, it's seen as maybe the sexy side of finance at the moment, which is quite interesting.
Jack, I'm bringing you in on this about Brexit because, I mean, you've written a lot about Brexit. How do you feel the media has covered Brexit vis-a-vis finance issues? Have they overhyped the impact of Brexit or underestimated or got it about right?
Overhyped. No, I don't think it's possible to overhype Brexit, really. It's such a fundamental realignment of our main trading partner with one of our other main trading partners, right? And it's going to be just a huge thing. And also then you have the political element, whereby none of the main actors really seem capable of dealing with it in any way that would inspire you to think that it's going to be anything but a total car crash come next March.
But in terms of the impact on Ireland...
In terms of the impact on Ireland... So there was always this idea, right, that, you know, Brexit was going to be terrible, but it would be balanced out by this surfeit of finance jobs that were going to come from financial services companies relocating from the UK. And I think a couple of things have happened there. First of all, I don't think we're going to get the kind of big bang effect of 20, 30,000 jobs coming over. Just because it's kind of unrealistic. If you really get into that and really parse that, I mean, what's going to happen? Someone's going to stroll into the trading floor of Citi in the UK and say, right, lads, you're all moving to Dublin. Just it doesn't happen like that. And so I think what you might get in terms of a jobs dividend for Ireland and more specifically for Dublin is the international banks that are already here will gradually add to their headcount. You know, there might be a decision about adding a dozen people to a team in Dublin as opposed to a team in London. And you might get that kind of gradual increase, but there won't be the big bang. And also a lot of this depends on whether there's a specialty for financial services post-Brexit and whether they can keep a lot of the characteristics, if they can carve out the City of London from the rest of the Brexit deal. Where were we going with that? Sorry, I've forgotten what the rest of the question was.
Well, just in terms of the impact, because, I mean, there's also going to be some traffic the other way.
Yeah.
There'll also be some companies post-Brexit who look at regulation and so on and may return back.
Yeah, there is. And there's also there's a lot of Irish companies that actually have the UK as a remarkably important market. So it may end up flipping that expected dynamic on its head, and you may get what we have tritely termed the Brexitus of Irish companies saying, you know, actually, my main market is really the UK, so there's no point in me staying in Ireland and trying to manage customs and excise and all that stuff. I'm just going to relocate to the UK. Yeah. And that's just another one of the many negative potential side effects of Brexit for Ireland.
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, we see it in the legal profession. We see quite a lot of English firms now opening up in Dublin, but they're opening up with two or three people, and what they're doing is they're hedging their bets. I think the reality on it is, I think Jack has got it quite right, I think Emma has been writing an awful lot about it. We actually don't know what's going to happen. We could have a car crash, or we could see the car crash coming and somebody turns around and says, well, we better put the brakes on this whole thing and we better get together and we better do a nice little fudge where everybody thinks that they win and we can spin it. And politicians are great at everybody coming out. It's the only time that you can have a match against Manchester United and Manchester City, and both lots of supporters can come out and say that they won and everybody actually believes it and they can prove that they did. And I think that the whole thing on Brexit is we still haven't seen the effect of it. And what I see coming out of the UK is an awful lot of people in business are now saying, look, no matter how you work this is not good for business. And when it comes down to it, whether you're a Labour Party person, Liberal Democrat or a Conservative, they're the ones who bank these people, and they're saying this is not good for business. So I think come around October, November, we'll start to see the real fudge, and come around Christmas, our Christmas present could be that we're getting a massive big fudge because I actually think that this transition period that we have of 2 years could ultimately be so long.
I hope you're right, Richard. I mean, like, the problem with that is that, you know, to support a fudge traditionally, you need to have people who want broadly the same outcome but need to save face. So they make kind of minor concessions to each other. But I think in this instance, they don't want the same outcome at all. And also you have the British political establishment is now held hostage by this bunch of loonies.
Sorry, Roger, I might just bring you in on that, if you don't mind. In terms of how you see personal finance issues going, because you've been covering those issues for 10, 15 years maybe, where do you see the financial services sector in Ireland going post-Brexit?
Well, just to respond to what the guys are saying there, I think one thing that Ireland really and Ireland's financial services sector really needs to look at is if we don't see the bounce in jobs that was kind of the initial kind of talking point that Jack had mentioned there, we need to question why. Is it because why can't we attract those jobs? I suppose it's a question that we need to be looking at, and from both policymakers and financial services in Ireland need to look at that. Is it the fact that the infrastructure isn't there? Is it the rental market? All the things we debate day in, day out. But I suppose that's something that we need to look at as a start point, how we attract more of those jobs, be it in a Brexit context or more widely down the track. I suppose then in terms of the personal finance space, sorry, you might repeat the question there,
Paul,
for me.
Yeah, no, it's just saying that in terms of where personal finance will go post-Brexit, I mean, for example, where is our financial services sector? What's our direction?
I think Emma's kind of hit the nail on the head already there. If we don't get this massive jobs boom, and I'm parroting exactly what you just said, we need to look at why, right? And I think that one of the reasons we're not going to see it is because different financial centres are getting a jobs dividend in line with, you know, what they're good at in financial services. So in Ireland, we kind of do a lot of the back office stuff. We keep the kind of the pipes clean of the global financial system, you know. Therefore, we're getting a few more of those jobs. But we don't have trading floors. We don't have front of house kind of stuff, you know. So we shouldn't expect all of a sudden to overnight become an area that will attract all these jobs. I mean, if these jobs are leaving, I would imagine they're going to go somewhere like Frankfurt or where Emma is in Paris, you know, that has a history of, you know, providing the 4 and 5 star Michelin restaurants that these guys like to eat in.
Yeah,
Yeah, I think we've got a very good history of the back office business. That's what Ireland built itself on. And, you know, and Emma, I think, has very properly hit on the issue of the infrastructure, the rental market. I mean, if we got 30,000 jobs, where do you put them? Because they're not going to come into Dublin. I mean, unless... Now, Leitrim might be a place that could be looked at for as a financial centre because, you know, because it, but that's what you're going to have to do. But then how do they get to
Leitrim? But I think in terms of that, we have that issue that's an issue that the IDA deals with all the time. They try and present the various hubs around Ireland that could potentially be useful for financial services or different kind of businesses coming in. But ultimately, if it's a case of getting business into Ireland and Dublin is the only place they want to look at it, there is a bias there that if these companies don't want to take a regional base, the IDA will always push that they don't want to lose the business for Ireland in general. So I think
it's not like old school FDI where the IDA could go, right, we're building a factory in Roscommon, you're going to Roscommon, because they'll just tell them to bugger off and go somewhere else. You know, they're going somewhere with transatlantic flights.
More broadly,
they're going somewhere with decent infrastructure.
We also need to consider whether we want to remain the back office of Europe or more broadly the world, or do we want to be higher up the value chain? And if we do, how do we get there? I think Jack hit that point that we're not in a position at the moment maybe to bring the trading floors of the city to Dublin because maybe the expertise isn't here. But if we want that to be something that we could compete on in the future, how do we make that happen?
Yeah, let's return to an issue that we covered earlier on in terms of the conditions for people who are at work in financial and banking services in Ireland. Richard, I just want to turn to you about this because we had a lot of, you know, very detailed discussion on workplace stress earlier on. But one of the issues there's no doubt about stress is pressure in work. And the issues feeding into that in terms of overtime, unpaid overtime. Can you maybe give us a sense of the law around overtime and what you should get paid for?
All right, well, look, one, there's this great anomaly that people have that you get paid for overtime. Unless your contract provides that you get paid for overtime, you don't get paid for overtime. So normally speaking, the only people that get paid for overtime is hourly rate workers. And we're not talking about that in financial services. But the reality of matters is that the maximum working hours for an employee in a week averaged is 48 hours. Now, you take out of that the rest and break period. So if they go for lunch for an hour, that's not a 48-hour week. You add an hour a day. You make it 53 hours between the time you come in to the time you leave because the breaks are excluded. But once a worker has been working for 4.5 hours, they're entitled to a break. If they're working 6 hours, it's up to 30 minutes of a break. So that's not much of a lunch break. They can't work for more than 6 hours without a break. And from the time they finish in the evening to the time they start the next day, they have to get 11 hours. And this is where the technology comes in, where the email is coming in at 10 o'clock that's from a manager that's responded to, and you finish that at 10:30 and you're back in work the following morning at 9 o'clock. At 8:30, you haven't had your 11-hour break. So the answer on it is it's 48 hours maximum and it's 11 hours between breaks, between finishing and starting the next day. But the big one that's coming in now, and I'm seeing more and more of it, is people who are not getting their holidays. And the law actually says that you're entitled to 2 weeks uninterrupted leave. Now, it actually uses the word uninterrupted, and that comes from EU law. And that means when you're going on holidays, leave your mobile phone, your work mobile phone, at work. You're on holidays. Don't bring the laptop with you and put a note up, I'm on holidays, this is who you contact while I'm on holidays.
But the difficulty, Richard, is that people will say to us, that's fine, I agree with you, I'd love to do that, but the employer expects it of me.
Well, then the employer, if the employer if you go off on your holidays for 2 weeks and you come back and the employer has called you into the disciplinary, then you get on to the union and the union fills out a form that they send down to the WRC saying, I have been penalised for exercising my rights under the Organisation of Working Time Act, and it's unlimited jurisdiction, and can I have my compensation?
Do you think there's an issue there, Richard, that people, it's all very fine and well that the people know that they're entitled to something, but they fear that maybe the cultural backlash in a company, that if they're seen as the person putting up their hand and say, well, hold on a second, my entitlements weren't held up, that it marks them out as someone who potentially isn't going to get the promotion they desired, or they feel like they've broken their back for 5, 6, 7 years doing those kind of hours and they want to see the payoff, so they don't want to be the person to put their hand up now. And there's almost a culture of fear in organisations, and I suppose that's a problem.
Emma, you're absolutely right, and I suppose I would see this on a daily basis with people that come in to me. Again, normally when they've come in to me, the question they'll be asked is, how much of a fight do you want? And generally speaking, by the time they've arrived in the solicitor or the union, that's exactly what they want. And you're seeing people now who are working what I call 24/7, 365. And they're coming in, they've got stressed out, they don't get the promotion, they haven't got the stripe for the senior management post, they haven't been given the BMW, and they're turning around and saying, all right, enough is enough. You're equally getting people who are saying, look, I actually have got to the top. It mightn't be the very top in the organisation, but it's the top where I want to go. I want to be able to go to the school plays. I want to be able to go to the teacher meetings. I want to be able to go to the birthdays. This is what I want to be able to do. I'm happy where I am and I'm happy to stay there. But a lot more senior people now, I mean, if you look at the workplace relations and you look at the Labour Court decisions, they generally speaking are people on lower grades who are bringing the cases. Some higher grade people are coming in. But it's surprising if you take a financial organisation, a big financial organisation or a big company, who has one worker who's going down saying, I want my 2 weeks uninterrupted leave. I got put under a disciplinary or called into a meeting because of it. I'm going to fight my case. It's surprising how quickly the larger legal firms are down knocking at my door saying, can we get this case settled for a lot of money? Because the last thing we want to do is have 1,000 other employees turn around and say, oh, according to the Labour Court, I'm entitled to 2 weeks off. I'm entitled to turn off my mobile phone and my laptop. So that is the big issue that's coming in. But we're certainly seeing people getting quite stressed out, become quite ill because of it. And the issue on it is, this is health and safety law. So the fact that the employer says, well, we need somebody to be contacted 24/7. The answer on that is no. This is health and safety. And it's no different than having, I would regard working people like that as no different than having an electric socket where you've got two live wires stuck into and you've no plug. Somebody's going to get injured. So it is a health and safety issue. And Jack would see this quite a lot. And Emma, I mean, I think that the fear factor, that has to be taken on by unions or solicitors to actually fight these for people.
Yeah. Just being in there, Emma, because I'm conscious that you wrote an article for the Sunday Business Post a few weeks back about interns. I'm just wondering, what was your experience researching that article? I mean, for example, would interns have the capacity to speak up, or do they feel that they have the capacity to speak up if they have an issue at work?
I think that to mention that fear factor again, I suppose if you're at the very start of your career, your capacity to maybe to voice that your discontent is much lower because you feel like you're only getting your foot in the door and you don't want to rock the boat. And unfortunately, I think that the fight that Richard mentioned there, the people who are willing to take on the fight, unfortunately, aren't the interns. And interns are in such a dubious position in companies, in that they don't have any legal footing. There's no legal definition in our employment legislation of what an intern is. So it comes down effectively to the sort of nature of what they're doing. So if a person, for example, is working under a contract of employment, they then should, in theory, have the same protection under employment law as other employees. But the nature of the relationship between an intern and a company is often a bit of a grey area, because sometimes someone could be sitting there shadowing a working employee in the company and they're not actually carrying out tasks. Other times, and we've seen plenty of cases of this, and Jack has written extensively on JobBridge, for example, cases where interns are effectively being used to do work at no cost or very little cost. So I suppose in a situation where an intern is effectively being exploited, they don't really have have much of a leg to stand on, because maybe they feel, well, I want to work here, I want to work in this industry, and I don't want to be the person who rocks the boat. And I think that's a very unfortunate position for them to be in. And then you also have the scenario where most of them, or a lot of them, are unpaid, and we create almost an elitism around interns, because you can only afford to work unpaid potentially if you can live at home. So that rules it out to people who live in the area of the company or whatever. So straight away you have a Dublin or an urban bias to it. So I suppose, yeah, I'd love to hear Richard's view on that. I would say that interns are in a very dubious position, that we need to look at it legally. The UK, for example, has done a working practices review in which they specifically highlighted exploitative unpaid internships. I think Ireland is behind the curve in this, and it's something that we need to look at, because it's across every industry. You've got it. My own experience of working in media would be somewhere there'd be a lot of internships, finance, law. It's not limited to any one sector, and I do think it's something that we've dropped the ball on legally.
All right, Emma, can I come in there? I mean, I actually will disagree with you in one way and agree with you in others. The definition, there is no definition of interns. They're workers. And under all our employment legislation, they would actually be classified as workers. Interns have come in to me and said, look, I didn't get paid, I've been exploited, and I'm really annoyed about the fact that I did 6 months in this company or 3 months in this company, and, you know, I had the promise of getting a great job and I ended up getting nothing. What can I do? And I'll turn around to them and I said, well, there's 9 claims I can bring to start with. And they said, well, I haven't even given you the instructions. And I say, well, I know there's 9 claims to start with. So we can start with those, because you didn't get the national minimum wage. If you didn't get the national minimum wage, you didn't get paid public holidays. You didn't get paid your annual leave. Chances are you were running around, doing all kinds of hours, and you didn't get your rest breaks. And we can usually work out about 8 to 9 claims before they even give us the instructions. And where this happens, again, the employers tend to jump up and down and say, oh, they were an intern. And we say, yeah, if they were a job bridge intern, then there was rules and regulations. If they were this new category of, oh, we're giving an internship. To be honest with you, it's everything from restaurants, which appear now to have interns to be trained how to serve a table, you know, for a week, unpaid. And it happens in the financial industry as well. I will accept a situation where somebody's coming in shadowing somebody. In other words, they're not going to do anything. They're just going to walk behind and see somebody. And they're going to do that for a week or 2.
And that probably covers all the sort of transition year scenario, potentially, where you're just sitting in an office.
That's sitting in an office. But it's the person who's brought in and is sat at a desk, and they follow somebody for a couple of days, and then they're told, look, here's a load of forms. I want you to go through them and deal with them. They're workers, and therefore they have the same rights as any other worker, and they have to be treated that way. And we have this great thing that comes out and says interns. Well, I have a simple thing, they're workers.
And have you seen, Richard, have you seen companies kind of say, in cases where you've dealt with those kind of cases, would you see companies argue that the person isn't, they're not under a contract of employment, they don't have any defined tasks, they're just partaking in, I suppose, an educational exercise, for want of a better word, that they're there?
Yeah,
I suppose that's the defence that people put forward. I'd just be interested to see how they can possibly post a job and then claim that it's not a job.
Yeah, we get that defence all the time. And it usually takes us a couple of days to respond, because it takes us that length of time to get off the floor with laughter. When they raise it down in the WRC, they rarely get to the Labour Court on those, that they won't get to the Labour Court on those. Again, usually the adjudication officer has to rise for about 15 minutes because they go outside and bang their head against the wall. There's guffaws of laughter, and they come back and say, well, I haven't made a decision yet, but if you want to run that, I'll make sure that I put Mr. Grogan's name in the decision, because he'll be quite happy to be on with Jack or with you writing an article about how the employer claims that you are doing all of this work, but you are some sort of supernova of an entity that really nobody can understand, like a black hole. Yeah, you're there, you're doing all of this stuff, but you don't really exist. The answer on it is, they usually wise themselves up very quickly, and the checkbook comes out and the glowing reference is given. So I think the answer on it is, there's a problem. The problem on the interns is that people like the Workplace Relations Inspectorate aren't going out checking these things and coming down hard. The transition student who comes into a solicitor's office or a financial institution to see what it's like, what we would like, and the walk... it's very simple. They're not able to do anything because they haven't got a clue what they're doing. So they follow people around and it all looks very exciting. That's and that would happen in
And that's a very different case to the person who's maybe 24, just finished a master's and is sitting there beside someone who's the same age as them in the same work and not getting paid for it.
Yeah, filling out forms for in financial services, and they're processing mortgage applications and all the rest, and they've got a degree and they're sitting there. They're not an intern. They're like anything else. It's this. I mean, we in my profession, we have trainee solicitors. They've got a degree. They've come in. They get paid because they have to be paid because they're actually doing something. They mightn't be doing that productive, but they have to be at least paid. And even if it's only the national minimum wage, it does mean that they get a couple of hundred euros a week. And it does mean that it's recognised that they're workers and therefore the protections are there. And, they get their holidays and they get paid their holidays in advance and they get their public holidays and they're actually able to take on the role. So
it strikes me though that there's a twofold problem. I suppose the first problem is that the interns themselves maybe feel disempowered. They feel that they don't have a choice but to just accept whatever conditions they're offered, put up and shut up, which is a horrible position for them to find themselves in, a very unfair one. But maybe there's a need for, be it in colleges or through career guidance, or I'm not sure in what format, but more to raise awareness around them that they have got the employment rights, because maybe a lot of people don't understand that they do. In the way you outline.
Well, I think, can I say to you, there's a very simple thing. If they do bring a claim now, because it's in the Workplace Relations Commission, the claims are anonymised. So it's a worker versus an employer is what it's in, or a worker versus a financial institution. Their name isn't there, so they can actually bring their claim to the WRC through the union or using a solicitor. They can bring the claim down there and it can be adjudicated upon, and it's completely private. And
is it known to the employer, though?
Well, of course, it's known to the employer, so. but the employer has the
choice. I think that's the problem for them. It's the fact that the employer, and potentially the company of their dreams that they've always wanted to work in, now knows.
There's this kind of disconnect, isn't there?
They can make a complaint to the inspectorate, and they can say, "I don't want this to be."
I suppose one thing that's kind of recurring here is that there's this disconnect between the employment rights legal architecture, which is, in theory, available to all workers in the state, right? And then what people might feel is actually realistic for them to do in the context of their relationship with their employer. They may well not be labouring under the misapprehension that they don't have any rights. They may well know absolutely that they have certain rights, but exercising them, they may have made a pragmatic assessment, maybe more injurious to them than tolerating.
Let's put it over to the listeners, Jack, because if you've been affected by this issue, if you've been an intern at work in the finance and banking sector, and if you want to let us know your experience, were you comfortable in coming forward with any issues, let us know. We're at the Facebook at the Office Block, or you can tweet us the OB tweets. I'm going to have to wrap up the discussion, guys. Lots more we could talk about, but we'll hopefully have you all back on the show again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Emma, for joining us. Thanks, Jack, and thanks, you, Richard.
Bro. Thank you.
I've had a few people commenting on the music used at the start of the show. It's a hip-hop instrumental called King for a Day by a UK crew called The Passion Hi-Fi, and you can check them out at thepassionhifi.com. So guys, just coming up towards the end of the show, running a poll which is live now, and our question is, do you trust your employer to handle your personal data correctly? Please vote on the poll and spread the word. So thanks to our producer James, thanks to Gart and Glenn at all the Financial Services Union, and shout out to the crew here on Headstuff for hosting us. Until next time guys, keep in touch with us on theofficeblock.org, add us on Facebook and Insta at The Office Block. We are the OP Tweets on Twitter, and we look forward to hearing from you.